Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. There are few words in the English language as frightening as cancer. Patients and their loved ones fear pain, loss, and treatments that can feel as debilitating as the disease they are meant to fight. In most cases, doctors can't promise a cure, and stories of false starts and dashed hopes among research scientists are nearly as legendary as those of achievements and successes. And yet, there has indeed been progress, and there are many reasons to hope that we might one day be able to control, if not cure, many types of cancer that once amounted to an almost certain death sentence. Barrett Goodman joins us to talk about this. He directed the new PBS series, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies, based on the book by the same title by oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee. The six-hour program has been divided into three parts that will air on PBS stations March 30th, 31st, and April 1st. And there is a screening event tonight at the KERA studios, along with a live conversation between Barrett Goodman and KERA reporter Lauren Silverman. Barrett, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Dr. Mukherjee's book is a wonderful place to start, but it is not a script. What are the pros and cons of documentary filmmaking for trying to look at something that calls itself a biography of cancer?
Mostly it was prose. I mean, we had a blueprint. We had this epic, sweeping narrative that Sid had already laid out for us. And really the challenge was what not to include rather than what to include. And it's pretty clear in Sid's book that there is one sort of central storyline, and that is the storyline of Sidney Farber, the pioneer, the father of chemotherapy, and his transformation from a research scientist to a public advocate. So that was our kind of, you know, hook. That was our main character. And everything we did then sort of came off his story. So it was not overly complex to decide what to leave out of Sid's book.
I have to say that I had read a fair amount about Dr. Farber over the years. I had read the original text, but a lot struck me that I didn't think so much about when I saw the vintage footage that you had of children in these leukemia wards who often had just weeks to live, and seeing them lying bed upon bed in like the 40s, I guess, and 50s is very, very moving.
It is moving. I mean, childhood leukemia was an absolute death sentence all the way up until the 1970s. There were no survivors. And really, figures like Sidney Farber and the other early cancer researchers are curiously gray figures because on the one hand, they're extremely courageous for having decided to try to cure this disease. On the other hand, they put these children through unbelievable torment in order to try to save them. And most often, in fact, almost always, they failed. So maybe they got an extra few weeks or an extra few months, but the cost of doing that was terrible suffering on the part of the children. So this is how medicine works. It's a combination of sort of courage on the part of patients foremost, but also researchers, but also a certain kind of bargain that we're going to put people through something in order to learn from them. And so this is a very, I found it very surprising and very kind of gray ethically as I learned about it.
Gray ethics are not so much being used today, or at least we hope so, but you do explore the perspective of a family trying to make decisions about whether to allow their own child to participate in research that could be helpful, if not to their child, to someone else's. But that's easy to answer maybe in the abstract, but when you're looking at your toddler and thinking this could cause extra pain and suffering and not do any good, that's a hard call.
It's a really hard call, and we really wanted to include that scene. It's a scene of young parents of a 2.5-year-old girl who is at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, and she has leukemia, and she has a rather serious case. It's a high-risk case. And her doctors patiently explain to the parents that there's a clinical trial available for this girl. There's a new medication. We don't know much about it, and it may cause the following, and they list 100 side effects. And you watch the mother in particular as she agonizes over this decision, and it kind of dawns on her, wait a minute, not only do I not know if this is going to help my daughter, I don't even know if she's going to get this medication. It's a randomized trial, and a computer is going to decide one way or the other. So, you know, we have made a ton of progress. We consent now. We inform patients. It's a much gentler process, but it's still full of really, really tough decisions, especially when it comes to children.
How was leukemia understood to be a form of cancer, given that, you know, historically people thought tumor equals cancer?
We knew that leukemia was a form of cancer, cancer of the blood, a liquid form of cancer, pretty early on. And what was appealing about it for researchers in particular was that it was so accessible. Unlike a tumor that's hidden somewhere in the body and it's very difficult to access, very difficult to track, especially then when we didn't have these great imaging technologies, really all you had to do is draw a child's blood to see whether your therapy was working. So that's why childhood leukemia became kind of the proving ground for new experimental therapies during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It really was children who became the guinea pigs for chemotherapy, for the development of chemotherapy. There was an urgency to cure them, of course, because they were children, but it was also because they had this easily accessible form of cancer, leukemia.
What got Sidney Farber thinking that chemicals might cure this disease?
There had been previous to Farber some glimmers of hope, and it's a fascinating story, actually. The first inkling that chemicals might affect cancer came during World War I and World War II, when mustard gas was used against soldiers in World War I especially, and some observant doctors noticed that their white blood cell counts in the victims dropped precipitously. Well, leukemia is a disease of excessive white blood cell proliferation, so some researchers put two and two together and thought maybe some kind of diluted form of mustard gas would have a positive effect against white blood cell proliferation. That proved to be true. And we have a great story in the film of the very first patient ever to undergo this and the sort of miraculous remission he underwent. So Farber wasn't interested in that per se because he thought it was too toxic for children. And he really cared about children. He really didn't want to hurt them. But he did believe, okay, if that chemical can work, there must be others. And really, it was just that. There must be others. They literally tried everything they could think of. They pulled chemicals off shelves. They created chemicals out of bark of trees and flowers and plants and bugs and everything they could think of to see what might work. It was more or less shooting in the dark.
So if Farber wasn't the one who actually found a therapy that works very well against childhood leukemia, was it simply that he changed the way the medical and scientific communities were thinking about approaching this?
He actually did find. He found a chemical, and it wasn't, in his case, it wasn't so random. He had a theory, and it's too complicated to go into right now, but basically he had an inkling that a certain chemical, which was a very rare and highly toxic chemical, might be effective against leukemia. People opposed him. The hospital in which he worked, Boston Children's Hospital, was almost unanimous in condemning this as sort of almost Birkenwaldian, you know, experimentation on children. But he persisted. He really believed that this could work. And we have a wonderful story about the first child ever to receive this therapy. And his twin brother, his identical twin brother, tells the story for us. He remembers, even going back all those years. And so what Farber achieved were sort of very temporary remissions, very short but clear remissions. And as I said before, there had been nothing in childhood leukemia before this. There had been nothing worked. This worked a little bit. And so he set the foundation, and others who followed him built on this foundation and tried more and different kinds of chemicals that were related to this until they were getting serious remissions and then finally cures. We trace that whole story in episode one of our series, and it's a very moving and interesting story.
When you're working with archival footage, obviously you have to get ownership rights for whoever took that. Do you also have to try to track down the people who are featured in that?
Interesting you should ask. Yes, in some cases we did. In some cases, for example, Boston Children's Hospital had a wonderful archive of the very wards you were speaking of, the childhood cancer wards, and they had footage and they had photographs. And we, of course, were thrilled and we accessed those archives. But before we could actually use the footage, we either had to have permission from those children now grown to adults, and of course it was impossible to even know who they were, or we had to blur their faces. And so we very subtly, if very observant viewers will see in some cases, we only use bits of the footage in which the faces are turned away, or we have something kind of like a crib cross over their faces so you can't really identify them. I mean, this is now going back 40, 50, 60 years, and yet Boston Children's Hospital was concerned enough that somebody would recognize that child, now grown to an old man or woman, and we'd be revealing that they once had leukemia. So we really did have to be careful. Other archives were less concerned about that, but there were others also that insisted that we not identify these children.
I understand the respect for privacy. Was it frustrating to you as a storyteller?
Enormously.
Yeah.
We don't like restrictions like that, but we were able, we understood it, and certainly were able to live within it. And of course, now we have lots of contemporary case studies, stories of patients who are right now going through their cancer journeys, and there was all sorts of restrictions on that footage, even though those people consented to be in the documentary. There's very strict rules, so we had to obscure the birth dates of the patients, or you know, any kind of detail about their lives that might be in the shot somewhere. So there was all sorts of cautions we had to abide by in order to pass these HIPAA laws that now exist.
Your crews were embedded in two different hospitals, two or three?
Correct, two.
For a full year. That's enough time to form relationships with the people you're covering.
Almost 2 years in the case of Johns Hopkins. We were at Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center, which is a cutting-edge research hospital. We wanted to be there because we felt like we wanted to show whatever is the latest. And this is a hospital you go to when you're very, very sick and you really need whatever that exists is there. 60, 70% of the patients are on clinical trials. They have specialists in every possible, you know, cancer and subdivision of cancer. But we also wanted a hospital that was more typical, a very good hospital, but one that was more typical of most people's experience. So after a nationwide sort of search, we settled on the Charleston Area Medical Center in West Virginia. And so these two hospitals became, you know, our home for more than a year. We had crews down there. We had wonderful field producers who lived in these cities and towns and were there in these hospitals every day. And the point was that we felt we needed to become so much a part of the furniture in these hospitals that people would accept us, that there wouldn't be the natural resistance that most people who are sick would have to something like a television crew. And we got wonderful cooperation from both institutions. In fact, the doctors and nurses became our advocates and really helped us meet and then befriend and then, you know, carry on a relationship with these people. And we did get close to them. As you said, we got very close to not only the doctors and nurses, but these patients.
Is that an advantage or a disadvantage for a documentary filmmaker?
It's both. It's certainly an advantage in the sine qua non, which is access. We needed the access. We needed to be able to film the events in these cancer journeys. On the other hand, our field producers did become emotionally involved in these stories, and we lost some of these patients, particularly one little boy at Johns Hopkins who everyone was surprised. Everyone was expecting he would live. He took a sudden turn for the worse, which is very common in cancer, and he passed away, and it was devastating to the people who had been spending a lot of time with him and who knew him well, and they, you know, they persisted, but it was tough.
Filmmaker Barrett Goodman is my guest. He directed Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. It's a three-part series airing on PBS stations March 30th through April 1st. There's a screening event tonight at KERA, and Barrett Goodman will have a conversation with our reporter, Lauren Silverman. The Breakthroughs series, KERA's Breakthrough series, Growing Up After Cancer, is spotlighting the voices of survivors and following the journey of one Texas boy and his family through treatment and beyond. You can listen for stories Wednesdays at 8:20 during Morning Edition and find more at cancer.kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning. With classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Barrett Goodman, who directed the new PBS series Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. The series airs on PBS stations including KERA Channel 13 in North Texas, March 30th, 31st, and April 1st. There will be a screening event tonight at the KERA studios, and Barrett Goodman will have a conversation afterwards with KERA reporter Lauren Silverman. I should note the screening is a truncated version and not all 6 hours, so you're not in for the whole night. I'm curious about, I want to talk about this. You know, we talked about childhood leukemia. One of the challenges with cancer is that although lay people use that word like it means one thing, it is actually like an umbrella term for hundreds of diseases.
Exactly. And it was tricky to know or to decide which cancers to really focus on in a way. I mean, we did have to make some decisions. It was easy in the first episode because so much of the early history, the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, as I said, was really focused on childhood leukemia. Well, that began to change in the 70s and 80s and even 90s when breast cancer really became the focus of the cancer world. And that's largely because the breast cancer community itself became sort of the leading activists among cancer patients and began demanding better treatments. There was a history of awful, just sort of ineffective treatment for breast cancer, and they really... women sort of rose up and sort of demanded better treatment. And a lot of research focus and breakthroughs in sort of cancer technologies really focused around breast cancer. So we decided in the second episode that our case study, for example, our patient would be a breast cancer patient. And she's this marvelous woman who is a breast cancer surgeon herself, who then was diagnosed with breast cancer. And we watch how that changed her as a doctor, and you know how she went through this awful ordeal and came out the other end of it. So we do include talk about lots of different kinds of cancer, but we do try to kind of gravitate around two or three of the major cancers, and those are pegged to the history that we're telling.
How is modern breast cancer treatment related to the work that William Halstead did?
Well, William Halstead was a well-intentioned and very skillful surgeon around the turn of the 20th century who pioneered a brutal operation called the Halstead radical mastectomy. It wasn't just that the surgeon would take both breasts. It was that he would take both breasts and the muscles underneath and the cartilage and the lymph nodes, and the idea being that the more you cut, the more chance you had to cure. It was based on a misguided notion of what cancer was and how it spread. Halstead believed that the reason that cancer would spread even after other surgeons removed just the breasts was that they were missing cells at the edges. And so if you cut a wider arc, you would have a better chance of curing. Well, of course, now we know that's not how cancer spreads. Cancer metastasizes almost randomly. Very early on, for example, individual cancer cells can escape via the bloodstream or the lymphatic system and end up in far-flung places in the body. So the surgery that he was doing was essentially pointless. And yet the entire medical community rallied behind him. And this operation, this brutal operation, which left women damaged, so damaged and was very often ineffective, persisted all the way until the 1980s when it was finally debunked. So that shows you how many blind alleys cancer research has gone down.
It is fascinating, this idea of activism. It doesn't seem like there's any other medical condition, at least in the United States, that has rallied as many people in sort of different areas as cancer.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that has to do with how terrifying this disease is, how it occupies a kind of psychological space that's different from other diseases. Heart disease tends to strike kind of out of nowhere, and then something happens and you're done with it. You know, it's a different thing. This kind of an illness worries people. It worries people before they have it. It certainly worries people while they have it, and it certainly worries people even after they've, you know, survived it. And so that tends to, I think, create a sense of needing to do something, and people rally together. The other part of it is that cancer has been traditionally thought of in terms of whatever organ it happens to originate in. So the breast cancer community could identify themselves as a community. These are people who have suffered this disease in their breasts. Now, we know today that there's actually much less to that than we thought. There's much less segregation by organ than we really thought.
In other words, the cancer just happens to settle in a particular organ.
Cancers are, having been balkanized into to their individual organs, they're now being thought of much more based on what the genetic mutations underlie them. So you may have a commonality between a leukemia, which is a blood cancer, and, for example, an ovarian cancer, simply based on the mutations that cause each. So really, yes, cancer is a lot of different diseases, but curiously, we're now coming back to the idea that cancer has commonalities between these diseases that are actually targetable, that are actually things we can go after to cure them. And so something that might help a child with leukemia could conceivably help a woman with ovarian cancer, where, you know, 20 years ago that was inconceivable. And so that's what one of the very exciting new frontiers of cancer research is how to, as Sid puts it, as Siddhartha Mukherjee puts it, how to find the genetic wormholes that connect different sorts of cancer.
Another frustration for many people is you can ask, is cancer caused by our genes or by our environment or some infectious agent? And the answer is yes, yes, and yes, right. and maybe not.
Right. This is a principal subject of our second episode, the search, the frustrating detective's work to find what causes cancer. We didn't know as late as the mid-1970s what caused cancer. We knew that there were viruses that caused cancer. We knew that cigarette smoke and other environmental carcinogens like radiation caused cancer. And we thought maybe that genes were somehow involved simply because some cancers were inheritable. So they had no idea what connected these three different causes. It wasn't until some very, very brilliant work done by some researchers out in San Francisco that found out that what is going on is that we have a set of genes in our bodies that function to regulate growth of cells and cell division that can be affected by all of these separate causes. They can be damaged by environmental carcinogens, by viruses, or just by random copying errors. And it's those particular genes that underlie all of cancer. They're called oncogenes. It got even more complicated than that. But that's essentially the great breakthrough in understanding what cancer was. Now that we know it's essentially a disease of genes, there's all sorts of possibilities about how to combat it.
What's the relationship between the fact that we can get cancer and the fact that we have bodies that grow and heal themselves and, replace worn-out skin and that sort of thing?
That's the rub, because the thing that's so devastatingly complex and devious about cancer is that it's basically the flip side of what keeps us alive. In other words, the very things that make us grow and survive, the sort of division of cells, the instinct the instinct of cells to keep dividing and growing and so on, those very energies and forces unleashed are cancer. So it's a perfection in a way of our bodily drives. It's sort of immortality. I mean, if cancer didn't kill us, it would keep us growing, forever. We'd become immortal. These cells are immortal. They don't die. That's the very problem with them. They don't die until they kill us, and then they die. So it makes it so difficult to deal with because, for example, our immune system doesn't recognize it as being different from us. It's basically us. It is ourselves gone wrong. And it makes it so devilishly intractable.
How did radiation therapy, it's interesting that the radiation can cause cancer and yet targeted radiation can also shrink cancer. How did that develop into something that could be used as one tool in the arsenal that oncologists have against cancer?
It's a very similar story to surgery in that when it was first discovered, the X-ray was first discovered, there's some very bright people had the notion that, well, if there's particles of energy that can penetrate the skin and illuminate parts of the body. Maybe it can be harnessed to actually destroy cancer cells. And that was a correct assumption. They began experimenting with it. They noticed that it could shrink tumors. And then they came to the conclusion, well, let's do more of it. Let's attack with a greater energy and put more radiation into the body. And many of these researchers tried it on themselves or were sort of careless about handling it. And many of the early researchers died from, including Marie Curie, for example, from handling radiation sort of carelessly. They had no idea that what was happening was that the radiation was not only killing the cells, but it was changing them internally. It was damaging the DNA inside cells in such a way as to give rise to cancer. And as I just said earlier, cancer is damaged genes. So like radical surgery, radical radiation was something that was initially embraced and only later discovered to be harmful.
Cancer is, in many cases, an existential health crisis, but we can't neglect the fact that for many families, it's also a financial crisis. It's incredibly expensive, even if you have health insurance, to deal with cancer, even if you come out alive at the end of it.
Someone says in our film that cancer is the most devastating financial thing that can happen to any family. The last two dozen cancer drugs that have come out in this country that have been approved by the FDA all are north of $100,000 a year. And there are lots of complicated reasons for that, the main reason being that pharmaceutical companies fail so often when they try to make a cancer drug. 90% of what they invest in doesn't work. And so to recoup their money, their investment, they need to jack up the prices of those handful of drugs that do work. Now, $100,000 may seem like nothing to save your life, but the fact is these cancer drugs don't save your life. They may extend your life a matter of weeks or at most months. They're not very effective. So then one has to make this awful calculation. Is it worth spending $150,000 for, you know, a course of drugs that is only going to extend my life a few months and will wipe out anything I can give my family and burden them with debt and so on? Insurance doesn't always cover all of it and doesn't usually cover all of it. So, yeah, it's a big problem. The solution, the ultimate solution, is better drug making, more effective, a higher batting average in pharmaceutical companies, and that just goes right back to better basic research. And the problem with that is that the federal government is not funding basic research right now. So it's a vicious circle, and we do need to do something about it.
What happened to Richard Nixon's war on cancer?
We're still fighting it, but we're fighting it with one arm tied behind our backs because of federal funding cuts. For 30 years, there was a bipartisan agreement that cancer research would be fully funded, that the war on cancer that Richard Nixon declared had to be fought by investment in basic research. And despite the fact that the audience may feel there hasn't been a ton of progress, there was enormous progress, really a lot of progress in understanding cancer, even in therapies for cancer. But only recently, in the last 5 to 10 years, as cancer budget became embroiled in the mess in Washington, funding for basic research has been capped. And as the cost of doing that research keeps rising, obviously there's a bottleneck, and people who have great ideas and research ready to go are not able to pursue it. And what's so awful about that is this is the moment. We've never been in a place where there's more excitement in the research community, there's more going on, there's more sort of glimmers of hope and things we need to investigate, and we can't do it because the money isn't there. The private sector has stepped up. We've got a lot of philanthropy filling in some of that gap, but without the federal government as a partner, it's really, really hard.
So this is not something that market demand would solve?
No, because we're talking about basic research for which there isn't really a market. Pharmaceutical companies do some of it, but they're so focused on for-profit drugs and translating whatever research they do into, you know, marketable drugs that whole swaths of basic research are not embarked on by pharmaceutical companies. It's really been the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, that has been the originator of funding for basic research, and their budget has just been strangled over the last couple of decades. We spent a lot of time with Harold Varmus, the recently he just recently announced his decision to step down, but you know, he just complained bitterly about all the things that they can't do, which they'd like to do. And again, it is, I mean, even so, the news is good out there. There's so much going on. There's so much reason for optimism. But we'd get there much faster if we didn't have this problem.
People know they shouldn't smoke. People know that if they have to be around some kind of industrial chemicals, they need to protect themselves from exposure. But I'm wondering, other than those pretty basic things, have we made progress in preventing cancer, or is that essentially impossible given the nature of how cancer forms?
Again, both. We have made some progress principally because of smoking rates. Smoking is by far the most important preventable cause of cancer.
And not just lung cancer.
Not just lung cancer. And it's particularly virulent kinds of cancer, cancers for which we don't have many therapies. So it's a double whammy. But cancer rates have dropped significantly in this country, not around the world. And that has had a very significant impact on the rates of lots of different kinds of cancer, particularly lung cancer. However, we have not identified many other preventable carcinogens. Obesity looks like it's definitely tied to cancer, and that's the next epidemic. And we need to get a hold of that because that could erase all the gains we've made from smoking. But beyond smoking and obesity, as you pointed out, there are a few identifiable carcinogens, asbestos, benzene, a few formaldehyde, a few handful of them. But many, many cancers have an unknown origin. Something like 50% of all cancers have no known cause and may just be the result of random copying errors. And so it's important that people don't get crazy about this because there's a lot of misinformation out there. And many, many cancers are not preventable.
We're speaking this hour with Barrett Goodman, who directed the PBS series Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. He's in town for a screening event tonight at KERA. Also, remember that KERA's breakthrough series, Growing Up After Cancer, spotlights the voices of survivors and follows the journey of one Texas boy and his family through treatment and beyond. You can listen for radio stories Wednesday mornings at 8:20 during Morning Edition and find videos, family photos, and more at cancer.kera.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning. With classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Barrett Goodman. He's in town for a screening event tonight at KERA of his PBS series Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies, which begins in three parts on March 30th and continues through April 1st. He's in town for that screening, and he will also have a conversation with KERA reporter Lauren Silverman. You can find information to sign up for that event online. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Barrick, this series really balances on a very fine line. You do not sugarcoat the difficulty of cancer, the danger of cancer, the expense, the pain. On the other hand, you point out reasons to be optimistic, and you certainly look at things that have happened for the good in recent decades. I wonder if your sense of where that line exists between those two things has changed over the course of this project.
Yeah, cancer is horrifying. I mean, I don't want to sugarcoat that. None of us do, not Sid, not Ken Burns, none of us. We all have been touched by it. We've all been scalded by it. But the great thing is that this is a good news story. Ultimately, the news we have to bring the American people is that we are poised on the brink of a revolution. We've already completed one revolution. That's the revolution in understanding of cancer. And now we are entering a second revolution, which is turning that understanding towards therapies that are effective. And that's not BS. That's every single cancer researcher we spoke to. The toughest, the sort of most cynical among them all felt optimistic about the future. And so it's very important for us that the basic message of the series is hopeful. That, you know, having gone through the 6 hours and showing people the many ups and downs, the crushing disappointments following this, you know, great leaps and moments of optimism, all of those things have brought us closer to where we are now, which is looking across, you know, towards a day, not in the too distant future, when cancer is not nearly the terrifying thing it is right now. For just a short example, the whole field of immunotherapy, which is using the human immune system to combat cancer, which is by far the most effective way to do it, that whole field is basically 5 years old. I mean, it has deep roots earlier, but Sid didn't even mention it in his book. We had to tell the whole story since Sid's book, and that's how fast it's moving. And it is incredibly promising and showing results all over the place. Every week there's a new study that shows it being effective in a new kind of cancer. So there really is. This is not another false dawn. There's really very good reason to think we are heading into a new day.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Allison on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Allison.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I was just wondering, talking about the immunotherapies, I saw a program recently about using viruses like measles or the HIV virus to fight cancer, and I wondered what you had learned about that.
Yes, that's we actually have the story of the first clinical trial using that technology. It's what they do is they basically, the HIV virus is an incredibly effective penetrator of cells, as we know. It gets right in there, and if it's not sort of diffused, it will kill you. But they've found a way to take out what is harmful about it, but keep its unique ability to find and penetrate cells. And what they do is they insert a gene inside that sort of neutered HIV virus, insert a gene that will transform the immune cells that these viruses are finding into cancer-fighting immune cells.
That's astonishing.
It's amazing. And we have this incredible story of Emily Whitehead, the first child ever to receive this therapy. And we follow her story from the very first time she gets an infusion of this new drug, really. It's a living drug. And I won't tell you all what happens, because it really is a suspenseful, amazing story. But it is brand new, cutting edge, and it looks like it's going to be tremendously effective. The statistics are blowing people away in terms of what it's been able to do, essentially turning our own immune system into this really effective cancer-fighting weapon.
What did you learn about how doctors and nurses, people providing direct patient care, maintain optimism? And does it come from maybe a different source than patients and their families?
Those folks are saints. They blow me away. I mean, I cannot tell you. I don't know how they do it. Particularly, we spent a lot of time on the pediatric oncology floor at Johns Hopkins. And to come in every day and to deal with children who are suffering and children who die, and then to continue to come in and be hopeful and be upbeat and be optimistic, and I don't know how they do it. They're remarkable people. They have some other kind of makeup that I wouldn't be able to do myself. And not only pediatric oncologists, but across the board. We got to know very well a young doctor at the Charleston Area Medical Center. And we follow her as she basically works with stage 4 cancer patients who have metastatic cancer, for whom there really isn't much she can do as a doctor. But what she can do is to ease their suffering and help them across the divide that they must go to, you know, and make their deaths better. And the way she does it, the way she looks them in the eyes, the way she talks to them, the way she puts her hand on their knees or on their shoulders, and the true compassion that she feels for them. I tear up every time I watch the section of the film. So these really are special people. They wouldn't be in this field if they didn't have some kind of mission, I think, because it is just too tough otherwise. But you know, I really grew to admire all of the doctors and nurses especially, I think, that we met.
It's hard to imagine the course of a workday in which you might have very good news for one patient, followed by a meeting where you give another patient the worst news they've ever had.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they have to become inured to it, but not too inured that they stop being human beings.
Yeah.
Because, you know, aside from offering therapy, they're really their chief function is to help people through this. And this is the hardest thing that any of their patients will ever go through or ever have gone through. So it's the best of these doctors that know that and keep that in the forefront of their minds as they're doing their jobs, which is trying to heal these people and cure them. Some of them, of course, don't have that personal touch, but a remarkable number of them do, at least the ones that we met.
We have an email here from Don who says, you mentioned a relationship between obesity and cancer. Can you comment on this proposed relationship and the hypothesis that blood sugar causes insulin surges? Insulin as a growth hormone can promote cancer. Did you look into that?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of theories as to why there is a strong correlation between obesity and cancer. One of them is what your emailer just mentioned, that there's a hormonal relationship. And there is definitely a hormonal relationship in other kinds of cancer, so that there's something to that. Another theory is that there's inflammation involved, and inflammation means more cell division. More cell division means more possibilities for mistakes and errors and mutations. I was told by Harold Varmus, who is the head of the NCI, that we don't know yet. We don't know yet exactly why, and it's not for me then to speculate. But the important thing is right now is that what they do know is that there is definitely a correlation and a strong one. So don't be obese if you don't want cancer. I mean, it's that simple. Get in control of it because for some reason or other, it will lead to a heightened risk for cancer.
Obviously, you had to have buy-in from the patients and their families themselves. But I'm curious as to the process by which you decided the patients you would follow, recognizing at the outset that you, like everybody else, couldn't predict how things were going to go for them.
Right. And so what we did was we tried, you know, we cast a fairly wide net. We tried to follow a number of stories, knowing that some of them would end early, hopefully because the child or the adult was cured and walked out of the hospital. Others would have longer sort of courses or arcs, which was lucky that we had that ability and that access and the time to do that. B was tough because many of those stories didn't end up in the film, and those people gave us their time and gave us their cooperation and were tremendously grateful. And then we had to say to them, we just don't have the space in the film for your story. And so that was really hard. And some of those stories are online, some of them are on the DVD. But really, we had to boil all that down to a relatively few number of case studies. And those were chosen mostly because they either had some resonance with the history we were telling, or they were particularly dramatic. Their arcs were particularly revelatory of what it's like to have cancer. The characters were particularly good. A whole host of reasons for choosing the ones that are actually in the show.
Should we assume that the cure for cancer, which as we now understand won't be one thing, it will be a variety of different therapies depending on the kind of cancer, but does it look like most of them will be about turning cancer into a chronic illness that can be managed as opposed to making patients completely disease-free after the onset of cancer?
Probably the former, but even they're really, it's a little bit of a misnomer to say you can ever really cure cancer completely. Because as patients will tell you who have been told they are cured, in quotes, which means they've had a survival past 5 years, they're never really, their minds are never really at ease.
Yeah.
Because all it takes is one stray cancer cell in there somewhere. That's what cancer is. It comes from a single cell. So the idea that you have obliterated every cancer cell in your body is a tall ask. And yes, it happens, but most of these patients who are pronounced cured will live normal lifespans and die of something else. But it can always come back. And so the line between a kind of chronic condition and one that is so-called, you know, quote, cured is really kind of blurry. What will happen is that more and more cancers will have longer and longer lifespans, lower and lower mortality rates. People will be able to live 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whereas before they lived 20 months. Mm-hmm. And so that will be the great breakthrough is when we start to see that curve, that sine curve become, you know, sort of longer and longer and people's lifespans less and less affected by the cancer they have.
And not to freak people out, because you can look at this on the other side and it's actually a hopeful thing. Like, there are cancer cells in pretty much everybody walking around today, but
right.
typically our immune systems are able to cope with those.
Exactly. I mean, and not just our immune systems, but we have – the human body is remarkable, obviously. But one of the things we have is self-corrective mechanisms. When our cells divide a billion times a day or some ridiculous number – and it's not a perfect process. We make mistakes all the time. Mutations happen all the time. In fact, they're necessary for evolution to occur. But we have a mechanism inside our body to essentially kill those cells that are dysfunctional, that are mistakes, to find them and weed them out. It's not the immune system. It's another mechanism inside the cell. But even so, things get through. You know, mistakes happen. And yes, many of us, all of us, I think, probably have the set of mutations that would give rise to cancer if they were not ferreted out by this mechanism in the body. And everybody would get cancer if they lived long enough. If we all lived 200 years, we'd all get cancer. It's just inevitable. Enough cell division happens that the right mutations take place and poof, you've got it.
What have you learned through the course of this project about reading the... seems like monthly exciting headlines in newspapers and online and in magazines. How do you interpret those?
Some caution. I mean, you know, the history of cancer really is sobering in that we've all seen this before. There have been so many times during which there have been these pronouncements that we've got it. We've got the solution. You know, chemotherapy, that's going to be the solution. Well, it wasn't at all. It was marginally effective, really. Targeted therapy that goes after what's wrong with the cancer cell and leaves healthy cells alone, that was going to be the answer. Well, unfortunately, cancer forms resistance to targeted therapy, and that was sort of disappointing. Although it's still very promising in many ways, it hasn't achieved that kind of panacea that people thought it might. And now immunotherapy is, some people are kind of raising that flag up as being the solution, and it probably won't be the solution. It will be a very important weapon in our armamentarium. But what's different about today than the past is that we have a foundation of understanding of what cancer is that is completely different than 20, 30, 40 years ago. Now when they make a pronouncement about this is effective, they know why it's effective. It's not just showing some clinical results. They understand the underlying mechanism for why it's showing those results. And that's a completely different ballgame. So that's why people are so, I think, justifiably optimistic.
Barrett Goodman directed the new PBS series Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. It airs on PBS stations, including KERA 13, March 30th, 31st, and April 1st. There's a screening event this evening at the KERA studios, along with a live conversation between Barrett Goodman and KERA reporter Lauren Silverman. Barrett, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.